I remember thinking, if I wanted to stop now, I would have trouble. Don't forget, in 96, when I stopped, there was no information. There was no reaching out and going out on the street and shouting, hey, I've got a cocaine problem. There was none of that. And I just went and sat in a room on my own and just clenched myself or cuddled myself, whatever you want to call it, from the anxiety and the stress I was feeling, and just sat through all these thoughts, all these feelings. I wasn't one of those people who's fortunate enough to go, oh, I've seen the light and it's all good. It weren't like that. And I'd have a flicker moment like a month down the line after 30 days of being in full on anxiety. And then I'd have a moment of rest. And then maybe next month would be 2 days. Then next month would be 3 days. And it'd be good. But then it's like that whole cycle of change thing. You don't get into the new life and then till you maintain the behaviour, which changes.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scofield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery, or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. I'm really excited today. We have the legend DJ Brandon Block, who has been an idol of mine for many years. Brandon Block's name is synonymous with dance floors worldwide, with residencies spanning Marbella, Dubai, Hong Kong, and beyond. His energy behind the decks is as infectious as ever, but his hedonistic reputation is just that of legends. Brandon's current story is now the one of growth and transformation. In this episode, Brandon talks about the highs and lows of fame and how difficult it was to find help in 1996. Brandon, welcome to This Is Powerful. I'm so glad we got to do this, even though not in person today.
Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate it. It's lovely to talk to you.
Brandon, can you give us a little bit about where you're originally from and how was your upbringing?
I was born in Hackney, moved rapidly to Wembley from there. I grew up in Wembley. Living in the 80s was just an incredible time. I keep saying to people recently, though, but our age group, of what we've been so fortunate with culture, music, the whole growing up in 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, we've crossed so many barriers and transcended so many different cultures and religions and music. And I taught my trade in music and dancing and jazz funk shuffling and all that stuff in Wembley. Look, I got bullied a bit at school, right? Which I think is probably half of the reason I created the mask that was Brandon the Lunatic for all them years. Which I come to realise that it served a purpose. You know, I have no real regrets about it, although, you know, you struggle to find the real you when you live in a mask for so long. But, you know, it happens and you do work and you find your way. Back in the 70s, there was, and I was a Jewish kid in school. Well, I wasn't, it was a couple, but, you know, I was one of them. And there was all the scar stuff, the skinheads and all that. And there was all a bit of this teenage banter going on. Anyway, so he took me out, this Nigerian guy, huge. For me, he was at the time, obviously, because I was like this. And he took me under his wing. He said, come on. He said, look, he said, I can see you're struggling a bit over there. He said, come over with me. And I went, oh, that's very nice of you. And he took me under his blazer into the lunchtime disco, where all the funk and soul and, you know, disco music was going on. And there was a whole group of lads dancing. I was going, look at that dancing. I love it. And then my pal Yemi, who's took me under his blazer, turns out that he's the best robotic dancer in the school, right? So I meet all the lads. I start dancing and having a, you know, guess that's where my fashion starts. We start with the old soul belts, the Revell College loafers and the Dickie belts and faggy sweatshirts, all this. It was a really cool fashion. So it was like a early disco soul boy stuff. And then from then, our worlds, you know, whoever was bullying, all our worlds started, you know, mixing. And God rest his soul, one of my biggest bullies, it turned out, ended up being my best mate for many years. And he took his own life, unfortunately, 4 years ago, which was a very, very big shock. But I mean, our worlds merged through music, and our worlds merged through drugs, I think, I suppose. So musically, I loved the upbringing. I loved so many different styles of music and genres and, you know, the emotion that's attached to all those records. It's one of those fundamental, I think it should be a fundamental human need, because I think you can change any mood with music, can't you?
100%. What was the first record you bought? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it was a couple, but I think the first 12-inch was the Can You Feel Force by The Real Thing, which was, I think, 1977. 78, I'm not sure. I was 11. So, to go and buy a record at 11, I see my best mate, one of my best mates, John Jules, who's I say he's my mentor. He won't have it, but he was. He used to work in Our Price in Wembley.
Oh, amazing.
So he managed the Our Price, and I think I bought it from there. So Can You Feel the Force? And I think from then it was like that opened the door to my disco collection, and then obviously the local pub is our hub of social networking, right? We grew up in pubs, and pubs were our place of doing pretty much everything. If you grew up in pubs, you grew up in pubs, and you weren't like an occasional, I go to the pub at the weekend, or I go, you know, maybe pop in on a Friday night. If you go to pubs, you go every night of the week, or you go every night of the weekend, because that's where you meet your mates.
Well, it's your community, and it's your proper lifestyle. It's where everything happens.
Everything, you know, that was our social network, wasn't it? Boozers. And no wonder a lot of us got in trouble. I started DJing in my local pub, and that was like a moment of luck, as we would have it, I think. I started there. Obviously, we was in the pub. I was 15, 14 DJing.
Legend starts right there.
Well, there you go. That is glamour. That's the glamorous life. Yeah. That is glamour. It's not now, but it was then. That was a fantastic place to be. Learning your trade, that's the start of my journey, let's say. And obviously, you know, being in pubs all the time aided and abetted the other thing, the drink.
Yeah, so it goes hand in hand. But what a great opportunity to start there, because it's with all your mates. You got like your best crowd as well, haven't you? And you could just work with it and learn your trade. Probably one of the best ways to do it, I would imagine.
No, it was an incredible time to have that opportunity and to grow up with that environment, especially with all that soul and disco. And I loved it, mate. And, you know,
when Ibiza came around in 87, and that period for me, so romantic. It's just like it was I wasn't around in the 60s, but I can imagine it was like a movement like then. Everyone just came together, no matter where you're from or whatever you've done for a living.
And it was en masse then. It wasn't like, you know, you say the 60s, Woodstock and stuff like that. And then, you know, the early Glastonbury's, and everyone was like-minded then. But there was a lot of division in, you know, 80s and 70s and 80s, just, you know, culturally, racially, everything. There was a lot of division. You know, music brought that whole thing together, literally, as you said. It's like a bringing together of everything. It's been an evolution. It's not been a revolution. I can look back and go, you know what, I was very grateful to be part of that, you know, the Space Terrace with Alex, and that, you know, first cohort of DJs who lived there and created our mark and did what we did and had the most excellent times ever, and fun and merrymaking and just sheer abandonment of anything normal. It was so.
But did you realize at the time, Brandon, like how your name would be banded around the world and how you'd actually become a legend at the time? Did you comprehend that?
I think none of us comprehended that was going to happen. I think we all just did what we did because it was happening. We were in the music game. We were DJs, which, you know, who would know the club scene would take off the way it did? You know, there was obviously people wanted to escape from what was going on. The drugs were around, so just happened to complement the music, let's say. But no, I mean, I never went into it for that reason. That wasn't my ambition. I didn't think, oh, I'm going to be a famous DJ, or I'm going to be a successful DJ, or going to do this for the rest of my life. I just love my music, and I'm just going to play it when I can. So this is why it was such a chance sort of happening. So when it did happen, obviously, we just got swept away with all the incredible stuff in Clubland and Ibiza and all the trips around the world, which stemmed from that. And then obviously being part of the Space Terrace of Alex, incredible. It was like the best club in the world. And it was, because it was open air. It was the only one. It was like, you know, I still can't compare it to anything to this day, even. You know, those Sundays were just precious.
drugs was completely normal, Brandon, at the time. I don't know anyone personally who didn't go through that experience in the rave period or take anything. Did you notice that you started to think, this is a bit too much here, I'm struggling a little bit with this?
I mean, I don't know how much you know about me, mate, but I was properly, you know, entrenched is the word, in this life and this. My behaviours and my drug taking got really bad and quickly. It wasn't like extended over a good few years. I mean, the first, let's say, 8 to 10 years of my using, I got to the stage of maxed out and rock bottom pretty quick. You know, I was taking a lot. Consciously, I probably knew a couple of years before I got really bad that I was in trouble. I remember one morning, because I was taking it for breakfast, mate. I was putting it on my cornflakes and all sorts. I was doing the whole Tony Montana thing. And I was literally that amount. It's ridiculous. When I think about it now, I don't even know how to survive myself. But with me, I get to these moments and I have these moments. And when I have those moments, things change. But it takes me to get to those moments. And I've done it with smoking. I've done it with drugs. I've done it with other thinking problems, behaviors, you know, all this stuff. Like, I put a lot of weight on. So I changed that one morning when it went just, it got to that stage of sort of ting, something twists in my head. Maybe the pathways, neural pathways align or something. So I remember thinking, if I wanted to stop now, I would have trouble. And there was a moment and I thought, I would need help. I don't know where to start to get. Don't forget, in 96, when I stopped, there was no information. There was no reaching out and going out on the street and shouting, hey, I've got a cocaine problem. There was none of that. It was like literally find a way to a meeting, which wasn't even advertised because obviously it was anonymous. And I didn't, I'll tell you more, I didn't follow that route for my journey, let's say. But it worked for a couple of months. And then because my head was so confused and twisted from the amount of gear I took, it was difficult sitting anywhere. You know, not only with the concentration span of a fish, but sitting anywhere for more than 2 minutes was tough. So I found it, and I just went and sat in a room basically after that on my own and just clenched myself or cuddled myself, whatever you want to call it, from the anxiety and the stress I was feeling, and just sat through all these thoughts, all these feelings, all these, you know, crazy thoughts. I mean, my head was throbbing daily, you know, like I wasn't one of those people who's fortunate enough to go, I've seen the light and it's all good. It weren't like that. It was hard, really hard. Every single day it was hard, you know, and I've had a flicker moment at like a month down the line after 30 days of being in full on anxiety. And then I'd have a moment of rest and then I'd go straight back in it again the next day. So then maybe next month would be 2 days. Then next month would be 3 days. And but then it's like that whole cycle of change thing, which is a tool they use in recovery, which I love. And I think it just explains how it works. You know, you don't get into the new life and then till you maintain the behavior, which changes. This is why people struggle when you go back in the same environments. It's difficult to make the change because everything's the same. Nothing changes. So you have to make small changes, which allow you to.
Which is important to say, because a lot of people put the drugs down and drink down, and they don't do anything, and then they wonder why they go back on it.
It's very important because, you know, it's tough. It's not easy at all. And, you know, you need to make some small changes. And although they're difficult, get someone to help you. Get a therapist, get a coach, get someone who knows that game, and, you know, even go to the drug service and get like a worker to just help you look at those goals to set, because it's tough. I didn't have tools at the time because I wasn't aware of them. Just had enough. And I think it was just had enough. I couldn't carry on the way I was going because not only I wasn't dying quick enough. I knew I was going to go up here. And this is when I told you that moment when I thought, I need trouble. I need help to stop now. But I wasn't prepared to stop because I wasn't ready. And I wasn't prepared to put the work in to find out what to do because it was still too difficult for me. So I just carry on. I got to that stage where I thought, well, my heart's going to give up soon. I had a lot of other illnesses going on as well, physical illnesses, which were just not getting better. And so in the end, what happened was I was just unwell.
So you tried the rooms for a minute, but couldn't sit still. Then you had that moment. And then how did you find the psychiatrist that helped you?
So here's a story, right? My parents got divorced very early, right? Only child. Probably didn't have a great effect on my life. I remember once, I was about 13, I think, and my mom gave me a joint of Sensimilia. And me and my cousin smoked this joint on the way to the under 18s disco, under 16s, I think, even. And by the time we got there, we'd had a full whitey. We were like ghosts walking up to this door, like, I couldn't even look. And that literally put me off for life. And I think, well, I thought so for life. Well, not for that long. But anyway, so I had that in my head. And then I was at a family wedding and I got drunk and got abusive and got misbehaved and jumped over fences and ripped all this stuff. Because I couldn't understand why my dad, my mum, and my dad's new wife were all getting on. And we're happy families. And I mean, well, I'm not. What's going on here? Anyway, so I had this little rebel in me, and my dad took me to the car because my dad was in the fashion industry, and there was all the exhibitions. It was very glamorous, exactly like the DJ world, like you mentioned earlier. I was going to say that resonated with me. So he said, come here, get in the car. I'm sorry you're feeling like blah, blah, blah. He went, have this, make you feel better. I was 16. So I've had this, which now I know to be cocaine, and I had this line. I went, I'm not drunk anymore. So that was 16. I'm 16. So I didn't start on my journey till sort of 18. And then obviously about around 19, I was offered some and took the same again. And I think, you know, from that, the rest of the same is history. But so that was the first introduction to.
But how did you get, so the question was, how did you get to meet that psychiatrist that was really in your life and stuff?
My dad found him. He just got me a number. He said, look, call this number. I think it was the hospital. It wasn't necessarily him personally. But I called the number and I ended up speaking to this gentleman called Dr. William Shanahan, who is still my mentor to this day, would you believe? 30 years down the line, 35 years down the line.
Amazing.
He's the head psychiatrist at the Priory now. I still speak to him maybe twice a year just to catch up. He said, you were the worst I've ever had in my life and still are to this day, right? He said, you never relapsed. He said, which is unheard of. You know, I still get the moments. I'm sure you do. So I occasionally reach out to him and say, what's happening with me? Because he knows me. And I suppose it, for me in that moment, he would be my higher power. At that time, when my most vulnerable moment, he was my savior. And he did save my life, because if it weren't for him, I don't know if anyone else would have been able to get through to me the way he did, if you get what I mean.
Sometimes you just click with people on a different level, don't you?
I mean, you know, like in this journey we're on, little nuggets. There won't be one little nugget of information or one person who says something or one person who winks at you or shakes your hand or says it's all going to be all right. And you go, fuck, you're right. I needed to hear that from you particularly, or needed that little nudge from there. Or, you know, they say that those little nuggets of change which help the big cogs. And in cognitive therapy, you say to someone, look, Big Ben don't work on its own. You know what I mean? Big Ben don't just turn. You got to turn that clock with the small one, the bigger one, the bigger one, the bigger one, the bigger one, bigger one. That's how our thinking goes. It's like we smart with these very small faults, which can drive us mad, and then we'll go into the big ones, which make us anxious as hell. Or it reverts the other way around. You can make them as happy as possible and make the big changes, you know?
How did you get into smart recovery?
I was working in the drug and alcohol field for a company in London called Blenheim, who are, I think they were the first community drug project. So it was set up by the community in London to help people navigate their substance misuse. So I worked for them. I actually went to my, how mad is this? I went to my first CA meeting at the Blenheim project in Portobello when I literally came out of the detox. I was told to go there, right? By Bill Shanahan. He said, look, go to this meeting. And I was like, what is it? He went, just go. That was always an offer at that time, you know, aftercare at the hospital and then go to meetings. So obviously, you know, you do 90 meetings in 90 days and I get it. I totally get it, because now I work in that game. I know that roughly speaking, to change a habit can take up to 30, 90 days. And then like 10, 12 years down the line, when I'm going to work in the drug service, it's Blenheim. So I started doing that work and then doing my journey and the project work. It's called mutual aid. Right. So mutual aid is a number of different models brought together to help you in a journey of recovery. Right. And SMART, I learned of SMART when they came to see us, or Blenheim, I think, to say, you know, we introduced this model. It's from America originally. It's a model using CBT or REBT, rational emotive behavioral therapy, which is based on CBT. Right. So about rationalizing the behaviors and the emotions attached to the behaviors, which causes our inability to respond, let's say. That's why we react to certain things. So we don't rationalize. And I read the book, I did the training online, and thought, oh, this makes sense to me. God, I just get it. You know, like I understood it. I advocated for it. I liked what it, how it worked. Do you remember you used to go in the chemist and they were advertising it, and there were these little books. I got this one on anxiety. It was called Stress, Little Book of Stress. And I read it. And every time I got attacked, I read this book. It was like 10 pages long. And it just went, because anxiety will not kill you. You could probably convince yourself you're going to, you know, but actually the actual process of anxiety, i.e. the release of cortisol, adrenaline and all that stuff, peaking, it's called habitation. The period says how long it habits your system. So it goes right to the top of white knuckling. And then all of a sudden it'll go. I used to read this book and go, I've calmed down because I think, oh, I'm going to, you know, you think, oh, this irrational, I'm going to die. What's going on? I can't face the world ever again. You know, like whole irrational thinking. So smart. I just love the way it worked. It's easy to understand. It's not too much about spirituality because obviously that can be difficult for people to understand and get their heads around, especially at a vulnerable point, let's say. So I just advocated for it. And then we lost touch and it wasn't, the uptake wasn't great because look, you know, the 12-step fellowship has been going for a long, long time and everyone's the first port of call, which is great. The one thing I think possibly I could have done differently is get the support from the group. But mentally, I wasn't prepared for that at that time. You know, I wasn't in that place of being able to share. And that is a fundamental human need, connection, significance, being part of a team or, you know, a tribe. So that's what helps. And that's what works, you know. So I would highly recommend, if anyone's struggling, you need to get to a meeting somewhere. Smart Run meetings, you know, they're free meetings and free online. Again, you can get training to become a volunteer for Smart as well. So they train you, it's called Get Smart. And it's just basically going through the handbook. It's so easy to understand. You'll get it. You just read it, go, oh, I get it. You know?
I'm very grateful as well. I hadn't relapsed since I started 21 years ago.
Good for you, mate.
But I think when you go to such a bloody dark place, the worst part for me was just losing my soul. Like I had no idea where I was and I was stuck in that fucking obsessive thought process of like, I didn't want to shoot myself in the head or jump out of a window, but I didn't want to wake up.
Do you know what? I've spoken to a lot of people about this, obviously. I've never heard anyone say exactly what you've said, same as me. I think I'm going to preempt to what you're going to say. What kept you away from using, what kept me away was the fear of feeling like that again.
Yeah, I actually had really good happy moments as a kid and I could not understand. I remember looking in the mirror and just thinking, what the fuck happened to you?
Yeah, same.
Where have you been? Like, what happened? But I remember what happened for me was, it was actually in a treatment centre in North London and I really made a decision to take my life because I thought I've ruined the whole thing. Mm. There's no chance of coming back and living that again. And I had just had this moment of like, what am I doing? You know, I can't leave my mum. I can't leave this. And then I had this very strange thought of like, well, I can start again. I'm just going to use this and start again. And I think once I made that decision, there's no way I wanted to go back to that. There's absolutely no chance. There's not even, you know, when you look at an old movie like Scarface and stuff, I always used to romanticize and think, oh, that's brilliant. And not see the end when they'll die and everything goes wrong. But now in life, I think through doing lots of different programs and different things and learning, like what you've done a lot, I know, you get so far removed from that, it's just not...
It's not an option.
An option, no.
And you know what? I didn't tell you this. The decision, when I finally got to it, was so powerful. So what I realized for me was that the reason it kept me in it was the fear of living without it. The drugs, right? So I knew that I didn't know. It's the uncertainty, isn't it? If I'd stopped doing that, that's my whole life. I've stopped. What's going to happen? It was like, how do I live? I mean, all these questions at the back of your mind going, how's that even going to work?
And even who are you? Because it's a personality you build up.
You don't know. Exactly. I said the mask we had. I mean, I was the lunatic doing more drugs than anyone in the world. You know, I've got 2 weeks to live, by the way. I didn't want to give it. He said, if you go out this building today, I don't know if your heart's going to give up like now. You take so much bloody gear. So exactly right. What you just said, it's like, how do I do this? How can I possibly function without this whole environment? And then I was sitting in the hospital waiting for all these painkillers and waiting for the benzos and the, you know, diazepam to help me with everything, sleep, not sleeping, sleeping pills, everything I could possibly get alongside all the other stuff. It was like, Mr. Block, can you please fuck off?
Our cupboards are empty. Go.
You know, with this prescriptions like this long, mate. I went, I'll just add to it. So he goes, so I'm sitting there rocking backwards and forwards and I'm in pain, obviously. I'm absolutely excruciating pain. I'm going, I can't live like. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if you have those moments with complete clarity, complete calm, clarity, no cortisol, no anxiety, no stress, just those present moments when you go, and you don't think about anything, they're just there. I had one of those, and I think it's probably my saving moment, because it came to me while I was in hospital, and all that stress just left me for that one particular moment. I went, I took a deep breath, and I go, I can do this. And at that moment, I said to myself, I've had enough. And in that clarity moment, I said I had enough. So the decision was so powerful. At that time, it went dink. I felt my brain clunk. It went like, I'm letting go of that anxiety now. That whole thing's gone. Let go. Whatever happens.
So powerful.
So powerful. So what happens now happens. Just, you know, just learn to live with it. Whatever happens, whatever comes, whatever goes, whatever, you know, blah, 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 blah. All these questions, you go, just stop thinking. Just let it. You've made the decision and now you've let go of that. You go,
yeah.
But then obviously, then you've got to do the work. Then it's like, you know, that don't just change like that at all.
No, but you change. I described it like this, that I was surfing, like I was on a surfboard, but I was facing the wrong fucking way, going out to sea, wondering why life was tough. And then finally, that decision for me was like turning it the right way and going, oh, that's where I'm going.
Yes, let's go with it. That's a good analogy, mate, surfing. It's like you're struggling so much to get to somewhere you're never going to get to. You know, you can't fight through the 100-footer. You can't fight through the tsunami of thoughts that are going for this way. You've got to go, oh, I can't fight anymore. I just can't. And then when you get going, the tide turns you the right way and you go, I'm bodyboarding now, mate.
Here we go.
Get them cocktails ready. I'm on the beach in a minute. Oh, sorry. Get the mocktails ready. I'm on
exactly,
the
beach. Exactly, yeah. For our listeners, I think it's really important to say, like, when you're DJing now, what is it like compared to the last few months of when you was playing before you threw the towel in?
Well, you know what? This is another thing that's happened, another moment on the journey of discovery. So way back when I first went into the clinic and the detox, and I was there for 3 weeks, and I got told, listen, you got to change your friends. You ain't going to play music. And I said, fuck off. I said, what? Where's this all come from? I said, I've just come here to stop drugs. And he went, well, it's not that easy. I said, well, I ain't going to take drugs again. So whatever happens, no, I'm not going to stop DJing. No, I'm not going to stop seeing my friends. And no, I'm not going to move out the area and go live in the Swiss mountaintop. I'm just going to do my thing, get on with it. And I'm going back to Ibiza to DJ, which I did the next year. Clean, right? Here's a moment. This is when I knew the decision was held strong. There was a club in Birmingham I used to play at. And between the DJ box, and I was there. I was not concerned about ever being tempted, because I, as you said, that decision was so powerful. There's no way I wanted to go back to where I was ever, not even for a little dabble. It was too scary, right? And at the back of the DJ box, there was this little corridor, and to the back of the corridor was a toilet. So I'm DJing, I need to go to the toilet. I've walked in, the line on the top of the cistern or whatever. I've looked at it, the door's shut, and I thought, if you're going to do it, no one's going to know. This is your ideal justification, you can minimize everything you want. You can make all the thinking errors you want, and you could do that right now. No one's going to know. And I blew it away. I knew then that it was never going to be a problem about going back. So, you know, I went to Ibiza, DJed, went back. As soon as I'd finished my set, I'd go back to the room. I was staying at Pike's at the time, and I'd literally the year before I was partying with everyone else at the hotel. So you can imagine I'm sitting in the room and I just dealt with it, mate. I knew I wasn't going to go. I knew, and regardless what happens around you, whatever happens trigger-wise or, you know, urge-wise or anything like that, you just know it's not going to be powerful enough to beat the decision you made, because I was too scared of going back in that place. I couldn't think of anything worse in my life ever than going back to the pain and anguish I've just been through, you know?
And when you DJ now, because you're so far removed from that and you're free of it, can you enjoy the music and the process?
Can I digress a little bit about that?
Yeah.
I went to work for the NHS after the drug service. I went to work for the NHS in 2016 doing outreach in the local community with the people who have multiple complex needs. So that's crime, mental health issues, substance abuse, homelessness, health problems, everything, you know, doing and going to their houses, trying to move them on.
Tough work.
Tough work. And I did it. I loved it. I got some good outcomes. I had some really nice things happen, which was great. And then on the back of that, without being realizing that, I got burnout massively, right? And I was then going into the Celebrity Big Brother house. I don't know if you remember, I did that.
Yes, yeah.
I went into that, which was probably the worst thing to do in your life, because I'm having to do therapy on myself to get myself out of burnout, and I'm in this house trying to play games and not feeling my best. So the psychiatrist for the show said, "Brandon, look, I've always admired you. You've had some great times in gigs, blah, blah, blah." I said, "I don't want to see you put yourself through therapy on telly. Would it be easier for you? Because I can see you struggling." He said, "No one else probably can, but I can. So would you like to leave?" And I said, "I think it might be better, to be honest. I don't know how I'm going to feel." He said, "I thought you'd be out in a couple of days," but I was actually ruined. Anyway, on the back of that, I came out and I was empty. I was like emotionally devoid of everything. Not only had I, the job done it to me, but being in there for a couple of weeks had really sort of impacted on my emotional stability. So I went on the journey of personal development, which is like, you know, Tony Robbins. I did, you know, the whole empowerment thing. And I sort of got it. I got the whole thing that you can empower yourself and, you know, with some work. I didn't particularly like the loads of dough at the end, if you get what I mean. Like you, I got my stuff for free. I gave it out for free. My life was saved by a series of events and people helping me and, you know, me helping other people. So I generally didn't feel that. But on that back, I opened my charity, Happy Days for Everyone, which was lovely. And I was doing Facebook Lives. Like before podcasting was any good, I started doing Facebook Lives with people like yourself and, you know, people who've had overcome, you know, adversities in life and how they've managed to move on. Anyway, I became a goal mapping coach, right? Goal mapping is a fantastic model of life coaching, right? And it's so good for creatives, right? Because it uses pictures and words. It's not just about a SMART goal. So a SMART goal is a series of commands. And humans don't like commands. If I say you must do this. You must go and brush your teeth. Fuck off. Tell me what to do. You know, the little child going, nee. So I call him Muttley. irritable stomach syndrome. So all these demands, it's like you draw pictures. So you have a vision board, but you also have a route to get to it. So it's like a map that shows you how to get to your vision, which is the written bit. It's called whole brain, right? As opposed to right brain, left brain being, you know, articulate side and then, you know, the creative side. It's like, it works for me. I did a map when I first met Brian and in 8 months had achieved every goal. And one was including putting on a music festival for 2,000 people from scratch. So I had it all written on the board and I did all this stuff without subconsciously. I was commanding my subconscious every day without realizing. So I didn't have to write it down. I didn't have to, oh, got to do that, got to do that, got to do that. You write it all down, literally just watch your smart map every day, your goal map, and subconsciously you just do that.
Let your brain do it. Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
You do it. It's fantastic. So I digressed a little bit. It gets me back to my music. Brian is also a DJ, right? Back in his day, he was the youngest licensee on the Isle of Wight, right? His nightclub was the biggest one. Everyone used, like, famous people, used celebrities used to go from the UK to this nightclub because it was a really cool place back in the day. One of the earliest nightclubs in town or around, right? I think there was probably, you know, Tramps in London and Blitz and stuff like that. But, you know, it was very, very popular. And he was like 19 or 17. He tells his story. So he owned this nightclub. So he was like, he married Miss World or Miss something at the time. He had a Ferrari, like, you know. And then obviously Spanish travel came. Freddie Laker. Everyone went away. So his demographic left. So he found this program. He happened upon it, you know, on his journey. And he said, what I've learned is I listen to the words now. And I went, you know what? That's what I've been doing. These records I play, I sing them because they've all got love in the title, right? And they're all written about, they're all love songs, pretty much. So you start singing these love songs, you go, oh my God, I'm feeling fantastic. You know, like I sing at the top of my voice, even when I'm DJing. So what I found is that I don't need any of that other stuff. I'm happy to get the songs out, which people love, and sing them along. And see, I'm getting a buzz from it and I'm getting all the stuff that I need. I don't need the other stuff, the other distractions. So musically, and this is the other thing that came to me recently, I'd no longer, and it's, I suppose it's been about the last 5, 6, 7 years, possibly, it doesn't come into my head. Doesn't even enter my mind. Like, not even, you could introduce me to Pablo Escobar, and he could bring a sack load with him and it wouldn't even cross my mind now. So I don't get triggered. I don't get urges. I don't get thoughts about it. I don't get anything. all I get is when I go, I get performance nerves, anxiety before I do a gig, which is normal.
I think that's normal because if you're passionate about something, no matter how long you've been doing it for, I feel like that's like a normal process to go through.
Yeah, you want to do something good. You don't want to let yourself, they don't want to let people down. You know, they've come to enjoy themselves. You don't want to, you know, you want to just give them the best you can. But I think, you know, that fundamentally brings it back to that whole thing we were saying about music being the emotional tool that it is, you know, not just sounds. It's a language that, you know, language of love. Music kept me alive. Music wasn't the reason I started all this. Yeah, you know, music's kept me here. I'm still here because of music, you know. I'm still very grateful that we, after 40 years, are able to still go to a club, play music to people, make them dance, make them feel happy, you know, have a good night, go home. And I love a day party now.
Just one last question, Brandon. For those people, our listeners, that may be struggling, what advice would you give them?
I say this all the time now. I can't give you tools. What I'd say is, please don't be afraid to reach out to anyone. The first process in any journey is to break the mold, to start with something. And if it's just asking someone a question about where I might go, any idea I might speak to, can you help me? I'm struggling. I mean, I've said it myself yesterday to my therapist because I get a therapy. I still have to do it because I love it. You know, I mean, it helps and she's fantastic. So I said, I'm struggling at the moment. I need to get some stuff off my chest. And once you get it out of your head and put it on paper or say it to someone else, it's out. It's done. So don't suffer in silence. Don't be afraid to reach out. Please, if either of us can help, message us on Instagram. If you just want to get help locally, go to your local drug service, go to your local church, go to your local house of faith, anything. Just go and reach out to someone because people will listen now. I think that's the whole thing about this whole awareness, which is great. People will listen to what you've got to say now.
Brilliant. Brandon, thank you so much. This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholefort and at @this_ispowerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Ebba Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefort.